Mamma Mia subscribers, you've been asking and we've been listening. Now, you can get all of your exclusive subscriber audio on Apple Podcasts. That includes everything from bonus episodes of your favourite pods to exclusive segments to all of our audio series.
To link your Mamma Mia subscription to Apple Podcasts, open the Mamma Mia Out Loud page in your Apple Podcasts app and follow the prompts, or head to help.mamamia.com.au.
Move by Mamma Mia is the exercise app for anybody, anywhere. And in case you missed it, we dropped a brand new stretching collection that can be used to improve mobility and bookend your favourite sweat sessions. Mamma Mia subscribers get unlimited access to Move, and we drop new workouts every single week. If you're on the hunt for movement that makes you feel good, head to move.mamamia.com.au and use the code MOVE10 to get $10 off a yearly subscription.
You're listening to a Mamma Mia podcast.
Mamma Mia acknowledges the traditional owners of land and waters that this podcast is recorded on.
The following episode contains discussions of violence. Listener discretion is advised. It was a tropical night in Caracas, the capital of Venezuela, and 45-year-old Luis Navia's 25-year stint as a narco was coming to an end. A narco is a drug trafficker, and ever since he'd first tried the stuff as a young man, Luis had dealt large quantities of cocaine. It was the era of Pablo Escobar, of the Netflix series Narcos, of Miami Vice, of Scarface, of American Made. So much has been written and explored about the cocaine market of the late 20th century, but until now, none of those stories had properly included Luis Navia. Luis would walk out the front doors of Tamanico and wait for a taxi. He wouldn't know that he was about to be captured by the National Guard of Venezuela. He'd be threatened with a scalpel. Pursued for more than 12 years, Luis's time on the run was drawing to a close. Once arrested, Luis was sent back to Florida, where he would finally face justice. It's where he had studied at university and where his parents lived. He emerged in a white shirt, khaki pants and brown shoes, looking like he didn't have a care in the world. If he felt anything, it was relief. His life for so many years had been one full of secrets. He'd spent more money than you or I could ever dream of. No one, at that moment at least, knew his full story. I'm Jessie Stevens, and this is True Crime Conversations, a Mamma Mia podcast exploring the world's most notorious crimes by speaking to the people who know the most about them. In today's episode, I'm speaking with Jessie Fink. Jessie is the author of 5 books, including international bestsellers. His new book is Pure Narco, the life story of former cocaine trafficker Luis Navia, who he interviewed for 2.5 years.
It's a complete life story, 25 years of a roller coaster ride and adventure, which if I had to do it again, I don't think I could ever do it. It was once in a lifetime deal. I did it, I survived, and I'm here to tell the story.
Luis Navia was born in the 1950s to pretty significant wealth and privilege. What did his childhood look like?
Well, it was, as you say, very privileged, you know, for any kid living in Havana at that time. His father was the right-hand man to one of the biggest sugar businessmen in Cuba. So he grew up in a huge house not far from the beach and had, you know, a bunch of maids living at home with him. In terms of, you know, where he came from, he was in that sort of top 1% of society.
And he moved to the U.S., eventually, as a teenager, and went to Georgetown?
He left Cuba after the Cuban Revolution and flew to Florida.
Yep.
With his mother and sister. The father joined them and he grew up in a place called Key Biscayne, which is a, I don't know if you've been to Miami, but it's a quite an exclusive part of Miami connected by a causeway to this island, which is full of, you know, $20 million houses and Ferraris and Lamborghinis. In those days, it was still sort of a rich area, but in the, you know, the 40s and 50s, it had sort of been a sort of a place for retirement villages. But today it's really high-end Miami. He grew up, you know, again, in quite a lot of privilege. And I think his next door neighbour when he was growing up was actually Richard Nixon.
Hmm. The irony. When was he first introduced to drugs of any kind?
Well, he was into rock and roll as a kid growing up in Key Biscayne. And so he was obviously experimenting with marijuana. And when he went to Georgetown, I think that was when he sort of was introduced or got involved with cocaine. And then he got involved in the selling of cocaine. So he was just selling very, very small amounts of cocaine to fellow students and he was making some good money. But it wasn't until he met a woman at his birthday parties back in Miami that he was introduced to the Medellin cartel.
Did his parents know about this connection to the drug world that he was dealing with? Was he close to his parents in a way that they would be able to tell that he wasn't seriously pursuing his studies and that, you know, he was getting into a pretty dark underworld?
Yes, I think his parents were obviously cognizant of the people that he was hanging out with and saw there were sort of changes in his material circumstances and were trying, I guess, to put their son on the straight and narrow, but to no avail because he had sort of fallen under the spell of, you know, the Miami cocaine world, which in the late 70s, early 80s was a very swinging affair.
There are different eras where particular, you know, drugs take hold. What was it about cocaine during that specific period? Why was that the drug of choice for so many people?
Not being a cocaine user, I can't attest to, you know, the strength of the cocaine that they were using at that time. But by all accounts, it was very pure. It was, you know, coming in pretty much directly from Colombia or through the Bahamas. You have to understand that, you know, in the 70s, you know, marijuana was actually originally the sort of the biggest drug export coming out of Colombia or northern Colombia. But by the end of the 70s, you know, the price of cocaine had sort of gone through the roof. And so the drug traffickers back in Colombia were switching from marijuana to cocaine. And the first entry point really to the United States, or the easiest entry point, was Miami. And that, you know, created this sort of incredible cocaine scene in that city, which we've all seen in films like Scarface and documentaries like Cocaine Cowboys.
You mentioned his introduction to the cartels sort of came in the late 1970s because of a relationship he forged with a woman. Where did they run off to and how did that begin?
She turned up to one of his birthday parties and he was actually sort of going out with the woman who had thrown him the party, and he had sort of actually just left the party after meeting this woman and sort of went off with her for three nights of passion or whatever it was. And he sort of, you know, did the dirty on his girlfriend and ended up with this Aruban woman who was working for the Medellin cartel. And it was through her that he was introduced to traffickers, you know, serious traffickers from Colombia who were living in Miami. And then he fell into a job driving a drug trafficker in Miami. And through, you know, driving this drug trafficker around Miami, he learned the cocaine business.
I want to pause on him for a moment and look more broadly at the context, because in the early 1970s, the term war on drugs became popularized because of a press conference given by President Richard Nixon. How did that historical backdrop sort of affect his own life? Was there a real police crackdown at that moment in that decade, or did it take many more decades for it to be something that was taken more seriously?
Well, by all accounts, you know, Lewis had pretty much free rein when he was getting started in, you know, serious cocaine trafficking in the early 80s. He describes travelling on aircraft from Miami to San Francisco and no one checking his luggage, you know, leaving weapons in lockers at Miami International Airport.
And wow.
So I don't think that was the sort of the emphasis on, you know, law and order, you know, sort of we see today. And certainly, you know, getting cocaine through an airport was a lot easier in 1979 than it is today. But, you know, yeah, I think the war on drugs has obviously had a huge impact on his life, because the war on drugs obviously was involved in his own capture in 2000.
After he ran off and he's now part of this cartel, he's making more and more money. What is he spending it on?
Everything and anything. I think he was a big user of prostitutes, of, you know, buying fancy clothes, buying rhinoceros horn walking sticks, fancy hotels, the finest restaurants, cars. Yeah, I think he had 14 cars at one point. You know, real estate all over, you know, the United States. He was living the high life. It was nothing for him to go to a hotel and, you know, spend $30,000 on a hotel bill.
And I imagine as well that when you are dealing with this incredible amount of drugs as he was, that there's an enormous amount of drug use. As time went on, did the use of cocaine start to affect him, either physically or psychologically?
Yeah, and it was in the early 80s in Miami. He got involved in base cocaine. He was warned to stop doing that because it was affecting his work. And at one point in the book, we talk about a girlfriend of his who was sort of threatened by a Colombian assassin, essentially, that if she didn't leave him alone and dump him, that she was going to be killed. So, you know, according to Lewis, when he was, you know, partying, he was a drinker. He's always enjoyed drinking. When he got past a certain point, he would use coke, and sort of that combination of alcohol and cocaine meant that, you know, he would go on week-long benders, and eventually it became a problem, and the cartel sent him off to a Japanese hotel in San Francisco where he, you know, dried out over a month.
I'm interested as well in his relationship, I suppose, with Pablo Escobar, and most people will have heard that name. He's the Colombian drug lord and founder of the Medellin cartel. How did they cross paths?
He was simply in a business meeting with another Colombian trafficker at the time, and Pablo Escobar was there on other business, and they shook hands, and that was it. So in terms of, you know, them actually doing business with each other, it was indirectly because, you know, Lewis was working as a transporter for the cartel, and obviously some of the cocaine that he was transporting was Pablo Escobar's. But in terms of their personal relationship, there was nothing beyond them actually physically meeting.
People will know, either from watching Narcos or reading a lot about Pablo Escobar's life, the incredible violence that surrounds this sort of drug context. And also, obviously, it's a lot of illegal activity, and you've got blackmail and competing cartels sort of killing each other at points. Was there violence that Lewis was witnessing throughout his time as a drug trafficker? Like, what sort of things was he coming across?
Oh, I mean, terrible things. I mean, there's a scene in the book where he's having lunch at a farm in Colombia, and in the next room, a man is being waterboarded and then gets taken out and shot. And this was sort of happening while he was having lunch. And so, you know, he's asked to go into one room, sees a man getting tortured, then goes back to his lunch. It's just a sort of a part of his daily life. You know, how he desensitized himself to that is very interesting to me, because obviously that's a part of his personality that I was very curious to kind of try to understand, how you switch off that kind of sense of morality. Because, you know, Lewis was a moral person. He didn't carry a gun. He wasn't involved in violence himself in terms of, you know, hurting other people. But he was in a business that hurt other people. So, you know, how do you create that sort of mental separation, you know?
And when there were those instances of torture or murder, what are the sorts of things someone could do that would warrant that? Because he speaks in the book about going, you know that you're in this business, you know what the risks are, and it's almost a process. I think he calls it almost like a process of natural selection. Like, it's almost like dying of natural causes, because that's part of the industry. What would someone do in order to justify that sort of punishment?
Well, I guess according to him, you know, the number one thing you don't do is you don't lie. You know, you can lose a load of cocaine, but you know, you pay back the money. But you just got to face up to the fact that you've screwed up, and make amends for it, but don't lie. If you ever lie, you're pretty much you're dead.
What made him such a good drug trafficker?
If you ever meet Lewis, he's a very charming individual. He's funny. He's very engaging. He's social. He loves to party. He's the kind of person who's great, a lot of fun to be around. So I think he's a people person. And I think that that sense of humour is the thing that sort of, you know, helped him not only become a successful drug trafficker, but saved his life on a number of occasions. And when I first met Lewis through a mutual friend who introduced us through WhatsApp, you know, Lewis's idea of his story was that it was very much a sort of a slapstick comedy. And there are elements of the book that are comedic. But as I got into it more and more and sort of pushed him further and further on certain things, I mean, I realised it was a lot darker than maybe that he thought. So that was like an interesting struggle between us as me as the writer and him as the subject about what the final shape of the book was going to be. You know, was it going to be a comedy or was it a drama or was it something else?
Because the way he viewed his own life was obviously at times at odds with how you viewed his life as someone who, you know, isn't a drug trafficker and therefore might have preconceived ideas about what sort of person does that for a living. Was it difficult to abstain judgment when speaking to someone responsible for some pretty bad things?
Exactly. So where's the moral equivalence? You know, he'll say, you know, look, I'm not guilty of violence, but yes, you're guilty of working in an industry that engages in violence. So, you know, there is some sort of responsibility there. And I think that he understands that. He accepts that to a certain degree. But he can also respond to a criticism by saying, look, you know, we're no worse than the US government bombing an Afghani village with a drone, or, you know, the alcohol industry, you know, killing thousands of people a year through alcohol. To a degree, he has a point. Why is it that we condemn cocaine as a killer of people when we don't alcohol? So there are a lot of talking points. He had different ways of seeing things that ran up against my own judgments of those issues. And that was interesting because it was kind of like a battle at times. You know, we had some heated moments.
Were there particular stories or themes that made those discussions particularly heated? Can you recall any conversations in particular that escalated? I know that there was a discussion about the title of the book, for example.
You know, Lewis was very keen to write his life story, but then when the reality of the book being published started dawning on him and the fact that he had led a very private life, we were going out with a title called Pure Narco, right, which is not a title that you can really sort of hide from. Because from this point on, you know, people are going to Google his name and the word narco is going to come up. It was very confronting for him because, you know, the moment he got out of jail, he went into civilian life. He has a private life. He's a very private person. And now suddenly he has celebrity in connection to the word narco. And I think it's taken a toll on some of his relationships. I know that he has concerns about how the book will affect his business activities, you know, where he lives in Miami, things like that. So, I mean, these are all not inconsiderable concerns for him. But at the same time, if we're going to the effort of, you know, spending 2.5 years writing a book about the drug industry, you know, I need him to promote it as well. So that was a, you know, a struggle that we had. It was like, yes, we really want to do this, but, you know, the fact of the matter is your life is going to change after this comes out.
I was interested in the book, the sort of moments of violence that he was threatened with. So he was kidnapped more than once. Was he scared? Was he scared for his life during this period?
Look, I mean, Lewis is quite a macho person in a lot of ways, and I guess, you know, admitting to being scared is not something that you do. From talking to his ex-wife, I mean, she said that, you know, there were occasions where he was very afraid, and I could understand why he was very afraid. If someone's going to dangle you over a pit of crocodiles, I would be shitting myself, you know. Anyone would be shitting themselves in that situation. So to say you're scared is okay. But I think for him to kind of admit maybe what he sees as a weakness was a bit more difficult for him. You know, part of the process of writing the book was almost like, have you seen the film Analyze This with yes. Billy Crystal, Robert De Niro? It was like, you know, being a shrink, sitting down with a guy from the mafia and getting him to, you know, show his vulnerabilities. And that took a long time for Lewis to open up in a vulnerable way.
Why was he dangled above a pit of crocodiles? What had led up to that moment?
He was bringing cocaine through Cancun in Mexico, basically to work as a drug trafficker in certain areas of Mexico. You certainly need the permission of the local drug lord to do that, and he didn't have the permission of the local drug lord, a guy called Metro. He was kidnapped after playing a game of tennis one day and shoved in the back of an SUV and driven out to a sort of an amusement park which had crocodiles, and he was going to get thrown to these crocodiles by this guy called Metro. And what saved Lewis at the last minute was he made a phone call to another drug trafficker who he had lost $250,000 to the previous night. And the other drug trafficker got on the phone to Metro and said, hey, don't kill this guy. He owes me $250,000. And that's what saved Lewis on that occasion. Otherwise, he would have been crocodile bait.
I was in Cancun. I had been partying with one of the Mexican cartel guys, and we were playing pool. That night, in a pool game, I lost $250,000. Some people would cry over losing $250,000. To us, it was just chump change, let's say. But that saved my life, because the next day I got picked up. I was going to get thrown into a pit of crocodiles, and it was because of the pool game, because of losing $250,000, that I got saved from being crocodile bait, let's say.
You mentioned earlier that he didn't carry a weapon in what must be one of the most dangerous industries on the planet. Mm. Why didn't he carry a weapon?
I think he's a non-violent person. I think his non-violence was a sort of a badge of honour for him. And I think it's why people in that business came to respect him and trust him. And it sounds ironic, you know, for someone working in cocaine to not be violent when they're surrounded by violence. But I think that was very important to him. And by not being violent, he found that people came to trust him and that there were never going to be any problems. But if there were going to be problems, you know, he always had the violence of the cartels to fall back on, because the people who he was working for were very violent.
Another running theme in stories like Lewis's and you know, especially in this book, are the swarms of beautiful women who he surrounded himself with, the relationships that he had. What were his relationships with women like?
Mostly, you know, until he met his wife, I think they were sort of mostly sort of based around partying and having a great time. You know, money, cocaine, real estate, fancy hotels, fancy boutiques, restaurants. You know, the way that he describes the early 80s, it was like obviously an incredible time to live. You know, Lewis is physically, he's not the tallest guy in the world. He's attractive and he's got a fantastic sense of humor. And he prides himself on his etiquette and I guess the way that he treats women. He's a courteous person and he's a generous person. And to a woman, I guess the women that he met during that time, it was very attractive. Lewis had no problem picking up women. And to this day, you know, like when I was in Miami, I went out to dinner with him and his son, and Lewis was, you know, extremely charming to the female waiter that we had. And even after paying his bill, he went across the road to a Mexican ice cream shop and bought her an ice cream and came back to the restaurant and gave her the ice cream. I mean, he's just a charming old guy. I imagine in the 80s, you know, that was probably accounted for why he did so well with women.
I wanted to ask about his two children, because he describes himself as a normal father. Did they have any sense growing up of what he was doing? Because in the book, it describes him as leaving his house in a suit and tie and coming home in a way that might emulate, you know, a father doing a, you know, normal job. Did they know what was going on?
No, not at all. Not at all. And in fact, they didn't even know that he went to jail. So the kids were shielded from that. And you know, an interesting part of the book, I guess, is, you know, looking at how the truth of his life has affected his children. And there's certainly elements of the Navia family who believe that Lewis and his ex-wife, you know, didn't handle it in the right way, that, you know, the kids should have known about it a bit earlier than they did. But it's like any family. They, as parents, thought the way that they handled it was the right way. And, you know, I've met his son and daughter, and they're incredibly well-adjusted, normal, you know, Miami adults. You would never pick in a million years that they are the children of a big-time drug trafficker.
Did he, throughout the relationship that you've forged with him that I'm sure is ongoing, did he express any guilt for what he had done? And did he ever see the ultimate effects on the consumer of the drugs that he was trafficking?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question, because I think, you know, at various times he didn't feel remorse, and then there were times where he did feel remorse. And so I think that there was an internal struggle going on inside Lewis, as, you know, during the writing of the book, because the fact of the matter is that he really enjoyed being a drug trafficker. It was the sort of the best part of his life in some ways. So he has nostalgia for it. And in fact, he says, you know, how I have a lot of nostalgia for the drug business. But he knows also that the drug business is not without victims. And so, you know, I guess during the process of me interviewing him daily and asking him questions and getting him to confront, you know, the damage that cocaine does, he came to express that remorse and that guilt. And I could see the guilt, you know, and he deals with that guilt in his own way. But the fact of the matter is, and I'm sure a lot of people would agree, that yes, we, you know, we condemn drug trafficking. You know, the people who are involved in it rightly are seen as criminals, and they rightly go to jail. But they're also incredibly fascinating. I mean, why do we buy these books?
Mm-hmm.
Because these people are outlaws. They're leading a completely different lifestyle to you and I, and they remain fascinating.
And when an enormous amount of money has been amassed over, you know, decades illegally, what happened to all his money? Is it seized when he, you know, is eventually convicted? How is he living now? You've said that he has a business, but did he have to start from scratch when he left prison?
He pretty much started from scratch. Yeah, he did. I don't think Lewis has a huge amount of money. And of course, that was something that I thought about a lot. You know, what is the truth? What does he have? You know, what is he hiding something from me? And of course, anyone would think that. But from what I saw, you know, he lives very modestly. He didn't have to pay restitution or anything like that to the US government. I think it was $100 or something. He had a very good lawyer. He spent the money on a good lawyer, you know, in return for his cooperation. He was given a vastly reduced sentence. And I think Lewis would be the first to admit that he was extremely lucky and very fortunate. And, you know, there are drug traffickers who go to jail for 40 years. You know, we hear even in Australia of cocaine traffickers involved in cocaine deals of a couple of dozen kilos or whatever who go to jail for 30 years. So, you know, Lewis was involved in hundreds of tons of cocaine, and 5 years is a very light sentence.
Finally, I wanted to ask what you learned about greed during your time with Lewis, because you do say that ultimately this is a book about greed. He sort of suggests that was his motive, that money was always his motive. What did you learn from him?
Good question. I was watching Wall Street the other night, you know, with Michael Douglas. I don't think greed is good. I think Lewis's story, I guess, challenged me in some ways, in that I do think having a certain amount of money is a good thing, but I don't think, you know, living your life in a society that values money above all else is a good thing. And I think he came from an environment where money and status were things that were more important than, you know, integrity or being a good person. Or in a lot of ways, I guess, you know, a central part of the book is how Lewis came to terms with the fact that the man that he really looked up to in his life, who was his father, was someone that he felt like he never matched up to. And that, you know, he wanted to match up to his father, but he couldn't do that through crime. And I think that that is a source of great regret to him. It's something that he struggles with. But, you know, I end the book by saying, and I've said this to him just as a friend, you know, Lewis, you know, be proud of yourself for where you are now. You are a classic case of redemption. You've done all this. You've been involved in the drug business. You paid your price. And now you have a business. You have your family back. You've written a book. Your family is proud of you. You're alive. Mm. You know, you have two legs. Be thankful. In my eyes, you know, you have lived up to your father. I mean, that's what I say to him. That's what I say to him all the time. But he came from a society, from a background where money was valued above all else. That was how he grew up. So my background is totally different to his. You know, money is not so important in my background, but it was very important in his. So we had two different ways of seeing the world. You know, but by the end of writing the book, you know, he was interested in, you know, doing yoga and, you know, getting fit and, you know, doing the sort of things that I would do. Whereas before, you know, when he was preoccupied with money, it was all about showing off how wealthy you were. And I said to him, you know, that's no way to a happy life, mate.
No.
So I think, you know, I've learned some things from him and he's learned some things from me.
Absolutely. And I think that both of those things really come through in the book, and it's an exploration of greed and redemption, as you say. Thank you so much for your time.
No problem.
So some readers will find my outrageous story, my outrageous adventure, to be entertainment. Some will find it to be a cautionary tale. But from my end, I would really like it to open dialogue into changing the way we are conducting drug policy today. Up to now, the drug war has been a total failure. We need to focus more on education and on social welfare programs, something that will really impact and do a change for the better in the world we live in.
You can find a link to Jesse's latest book, Pure Narco, in our show notes. You can also buy the book at any good bookstore. True Crime Conversations is a Mamma Mia podcast hosted by me, Jesse Stevens. Our producer is Lem Zakaria. If you'd like to find out more about the show, don't forget to join our online community. Just search for True Crime Conversations on Facebook and make a request to join.